She has been cracking people up with her stand-up comedy since the 1980s, and newer generations are discovering her from her regular appearances as a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Comedian Paula Poundstone is always ready with a quip, no matter what the topic at hand. She has a distinct ability to improvise with her audience and engage with them as part of her act, and as a result, no two shows are ever the same. Current state producer Katie Cook had the chance to talk to Paula Poundstone ahead of her upcoming performance at the Wharton Center this Thursday. She started by asking Paula what inspired her to set off on a cross-country road trip to do stand-up when she was 19.
Well, I had started doing open mic nights in Boston, and there was, the Boston guys, and some of them had gone to some other places, and you know, they would come home and tell us it was truly like someone going to the other side of the world and coming back to the cave, you know, to tell the Neanderthals what it was like. And so I got a couple of phone numbers and locations of places from those guys, and decided to. I just wanted to see what clubs were like in different cities, you know. I never really felt like I fit in exactly in Boston, and my suspicions were confirmed. So I got a what they used to call an Ameripass, where you can take a bus to anywhere. You can ride the bus constantly for 30 days for $150.
Wow.
And so I would go to, you know, a place that I wanted to know about. I would go do what I needed to do there. And then I would get back on the bus. Sometimes I would take the bus 4 hours away and then reverse my course and come back to that same city. In this way, I would get my 8 hours sleep. I don't know if I was fueled more by adventure or ignorance, but I don't know. I'm glad I did it. I ended up in San Francisco, and I just loved it there. I felt like I had, it was, you know, Dorothy Gale's house, and it had landed, and I step out of the bus and it's Technicolor instead of black and white, you know.
Yeah.
And the audiences in San Francisco were so much fun to play to and so sort of willing to experiment. You know, everything didn't have to be joke. They wouldn't give up on you if there was a few moments where, you know, everything wasn't stellar. You know, they liked being in the laboratory.
Hmm. Did you ever just really bomb at a show when you were
many
first
times.
Starting out? Yeah.
Yes, many times. Yes. And the truth is, some of the circumstances, particularly when I was in Boston, I had just started as a comic and, you know, I was horrible. But B, some of the circumstances were so, you know, I was either following somebody that was sort of raucous and not just blue, but disgusting. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes we would just be in these settings where it was really, you know, the room was in no way designed for performance and audience. So there might be even like obstructions between the stage and the folding chairs. I was in some definitely. Plus, you know, back then, and particularly in Boston had a unique way of doing their shows usually, which is there would be like maybe, I don't know, like four or five acts and an MC. And the MC was sort of technically the headliner. The MC was the strong performer that people had come to see, and then the other people were like, you know. And part of the reason they had so many acts on the bill is that nobody had that much time. We were all really just starting out. So, you know, if you had five strong minutes, you were a genius.
So I see you as a pioneer of sorts for women in comedy, because you were the first woman to win the Cable Ace for Best Stand-Up Comedy Special and the first woman to perform stand-up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. When you were first starting out, did you have to deal with the female comedian stereotype a lot?
I think, you know, Boston was just, Boston was a really hard place to start, unless you were a part of this sort of core group of guys that, the audience had come to see them.
Mm.
And, you know, that was the flavor of the room. And anything that was not, sort of like they were, had a hard time selling itself in a, you know, particularly the guy that was the big star in Boston back then was a man named Lenny Clark, and Lenny was a wonderfully funny comic. He was raised in Cambridge, and so his buddies would come to the shows, you know, and a lot of times that was the core of the audience. And so, you know, there was a particular style and sense of humor that was appreciated, and anything that went too far out of that style was not appreciated. And so in that way, it was a bit challenging, I suppose, being a woman. They were very sexist guys, for one thing. I mean, they were, you know, I think the French word for it is pigs, really. So in that way, but, you know, I'm, you know, very lucky to have been preceded by, you know, people like Phyllis Diller or Lily Tomlin. You know, Phyllis, and I think Joan Rivers to some degree. I mean, I've never met Joan Rivers or worked with her, you know, or seen her live or anything. But I would just take a wild stab that part of the reason that she had this sort of style of comedy that she did, which was very, very, you know, kind of self-effacing, as did Phyllis Diller. I would just take a wild guess that part of the reason for that was the tone and temperament of the audiences that they played to, being surrounded by men. And that the only way you could ingratiate yourself to them, I think back then, was to say, oh, yeah, I think I suck, too. And, you know, Lily, who's obviously younger than those two and came along after those two, she didn't play that game. She was so just who she was, the way she was, brilliantly funny material. I don't think you ever thought about gender. With Lily Tomlin. You still don't. I worked with her. We were at an awards show last night, and she is as brilliant and wonderful as she ever was. But, you know, one of the things I think about greatness is that it can't be categorized, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the reason when there's, like, awards shows and stuff, part of the reason they go, like, well, it's the, you know, it's the men's supporting actor or the woman's supporting actress, you know, that's because they want to include more people in the awards. You know, it's really for money reasons. The more people that are included in the awards, the more attention it gets, the more money they make. And so, you know, so they're sort of spreading the wealth. But the truth is, there are people that are so great at what they do that you never for a moment think, you know, is it a black guy? Is it a white guy? Is it a Chinese woman? Is it a, you know, or, you know, Asian? They're just great. And all those labels fall away. They're just great. And so luckily for me, some of those boundaries had already been crossed.
Your trademark is your spontaneity during your shows. So I'm wondering, how much planned material do you go in with?
Well, I've been doing this job, luckily, for 37 years. So I have 37 years of material somewhere rattling around in my head. And, you know, my act is largely autobiographical. So usually, you know, when I first started, I was talking about, you know, taking the Greyhound bus and busing tables for a living and things like that. I tend to refer to stuff that's current in my life more than reaching very, very far back. So some of those things make sort of a skeleton, I guess. You know, I go on and talk about arriving wherever it is I am. And then in order to sort of, in order for the stories that I'm telling to be understood, you know, I have to explain about my family, you know, tell them about, you know, my kids and my household. So some of those things are a bit standard from show to show. But after that, I would say on any given night, a third of what I do won't be repeated ever. It's unique to that particular audience, the people that are in the room that night. And then there's material that is absolutely material, but it shuffles about from night to night. I don't have any particular plan for which material to do or when to do it. My favorite part of the night is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge, and I kind of use that from which to set my sails. So somebody may mention a topic that I have a story about or something, and I will... tangent.
You're well known by many for being a regular on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And for those who don't know, it's a weekly news quiz show on NPR. with panelists like yourself who make jokes off the cuff about current events. What do you enjoy about the intersection of comedy and news?
Well, I think a lot of times it's a really good way to, pull the covers a bit on to speak the truth about some of what goes on. Sometimes I feel concerned when somebody will say to me, they used to say it about Jon Stewart's show all the time. People used to say, I get my news from The Daily Show. And I always felt like, sometimes they'll say it about Wait, Don't Tell Me. Like, oh, yeah, that's how I get the news. I listen to Wait, Don't Tell Me. I always say to them, yeah, I'm glad you listen to Wait, Don't Tell Me. But I think that there's some better sources for news than comedy shows. I mean, the beauty of a comedy show, as I say, is that you can, sometimes you can be a little bit more honest about what's going on. But I would, as a citizen and a voter, I try to find a real news source that I trust. And by the way, I could be totally wrong. Maybe the news source that I trust is, maybe Simon Bar Sinister is running it from backstage. I have no way of knowing, but I don't know. I'm an NPR listener, but I also try to watch the news hour on PBS. The truth is, I mean, Wait, Don't Tell Me is so damn much fun, and we do talk about real issues a lot, but, on the infamous lightning round where we answer lots of questions as quickly as I can, nine times out of ten, it's really the news of the weird that trips you up. I mean, a lot of times I can manage to say, Obama had a conversation with Putin, or, the Supreme Court voted in favor of same-sex marriage. I can handle those kinds of answers fairly well, but the ones that really trip you up are where the answer was ferrets down his pants. and so I often just say ferrets down his pants in case that's the answer, because it so often is.
You also worked as a correspondent for The Tonight Show back in 1992, covering the elections. So I'm curious, do you think you would have fun doing that same sort of thing today in 2016?
Oh, I would. It would be a field day.
There's a lot of material.
Yeah, there is a lot of material. As a comic, I do enjoy the heck out of watching it all and commenting on it. It is fun. But having said that, I would also say that I think, and I think most of my brethren would agree with me, that we would gladly do without all the comedy fodder if the trade was just have reasonable people speaking honestly
right.
about what they believe and what they can and can't do in order to choose a really good leader. I think all of us feel like, yes, it's funny, but.
What's your earliest memory of being funny? Like when you realized, I like making people laugh.
I can tell you that the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Bump, they wrote a summary letter in lieu of a report card. And by golly, you should see the summary letter, by the way. It's typed and it's three or four paragraphs long, as opposed to now the comment sheet that they check off, a pleasure to have in class. Or this was like really very detailed. Clearly, this woman had been my teacher for a year. But anyways, the first sentence of the last paragraph says, I've enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities. So what this is evidence of, that at least Mrs. Bump enjoyed me, and I guess I was, I was doing a tight five on Play-Doh or something.
When you were five.
Yeah.
From your Twitter feed, I discovered the Cooking with Rhonda show, and I am a huge fan. I have to ask you, where did this idea come from? And also, for our listeners who don't know about it, tell us what it is.
Cooking with Rhonda show stars a character that I do, Rhonda Puckett. She has a cooking show on YouTube that is for the beginning cook, and she walks people through making such extravagances as, cereal, breakfast cereal with no added sugar, chips in a bowl. And I was born in Alabama. I was raised in Massachusetts, mercifully, but I was born in Alabama. And for a while, my aunt lived with us. And Rhonda's really a combination of my mother and my aunt, I think. I was actually out with my sisters the other night in Vermont, and one of my sisters, we had never talked about it before, but she said, oh, it's Paula Deen. And I said, you know, I've never, ever seen Paula Deen. She goes, oh, my gosh, she's like that. Oh, okay, I've never seen her. No, it was based on relatives.
Well, we're very excited to welcome you to East Lansing. And I have to ask, have you spent much time in Michigan?
I've done a bunch of dates in Michigan. I go to the Bing Cherry place. Well, of course, Detroit occasionally. And, yeah, I'm holding up my hand like a mitten right now as I...
Yes, that's what we do here.
As I talk about... yes, so the shorter answer is yes, many times, and lots of places. And it is a very beautiful state. Not only that, but we had Jeff Daniels on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me not that long ago. So I feel a very strong connection to Michigan.
Well, we look so forward to having you, and we want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
It was nice talking with you. Thank you so much.
That was current state producer Katie Cook speaking with comedian Paula Poundstone. Paula will be at the Wharton Center this Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m.